Good morning.
That's healthy. Thank you, Congressman. Much appreciated. I'm Tom Riley from the Roundtable. Welcome to our annual meeting session on Mission Possible, Writing an Effective and Enduring Mission Statement. Over the last few days, we've all enjoyed talking with our colleagues in the hallways and in these different sessions about the inspiring programs and terrific grantees that people support, and that's what donors like to talk about. One thing that they don't talk about as much, but probably should, are the specific steps that they take to preserve their donor intent and to keep their foundations on mission. As we all know, the track record of many of the big American foundations in this area has been not terribly inspiring. In fact, if the history of American philanthropy over the last century tells us anything, it's that unless you take very concrete and specific steps to preserve intent and stay on focus, and even sometimes if you do, you can get swept aside by the vicissitudes of current events, by philanthropic fads, and by the interests and enthusiasms of succeeding boards and staff. Very few of the examples of donor intent gone awry come from actual malfeasance or from bad faith or from foolishness on the part of the funders. In fact, almost by definition, these were very, very smart people. One of the reasons that this can happen is because they or the people around them haven't made some of the hard choices, haven't done some of the rigorous thinking that's needed to keep focus over a long period of time. But having a codification of intent or a mission statement, which can be a tricky business to put together, can often involve some awkwardness in a family foundation or the need for some courageous conversations or thinking, does make a foundation's mission clearer, does make it easier, and does make it stronger and more effective over time. We are very fortunate today to have two people who have walked the walk on this subject. Before turning it over to them, both of whom have very interesting stories, and I don't want to go too deeply into their biographies, which are both in your materials and I think are going to be part of their material that I don't want to step on, I wanted to point out they're both going to talk about experiences they've had, then open it up to questions from the audience. This is one of the few sessions at the roundtable meeting that there is no reporter, because we want to make people have a candid, open environment where they can ask questions or discuss their own examples without fear of anything being on the record. Kim Dennis is the president of the Searle Freedom Trust. Kim has worked with Dan Searle very closely on developing the trust and is now the president of it. Kim is somebody who I've known for a very long time and is, in addition to being a great source of philanthropic knowledge, is a great repository of common sense.
Telling that to my kids.
and has good advice on that subject, too. Linda, after a very distinguished career in banking, where she was the president of the Young Americans Bank, which is, to my thinking, one of the most interesting groups in America, a fascinating project, something that you might want to ask her about afterwards, helped Bill Daniels set up the Daniels Fund, of which she is now the president and CEO. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to Kim.
Thanks, Tom. I thought I would just describe the process that Dan Searle and I went through when he set up his foundation. And I'm not sure I necessarily hold out what we did as a model for everyone. It was a very involved process, so involved that when I went back through my files to kind of prepare for this, I've got a stack of papers a couple inches thick that was the most relevant conversation or discussion that we had, correspondence pertaining to the creation of the mission statement. But I do hope by telling our story, I hope there'll be enough that there are insights that everyone can take away from it and things that will pertain to you if you're thinking about this. to an extent, I think I myself didn't realize until I went back through these files, Dan Searle's, the process of writing a mission statement was not so much a matter of just getting it down on paper, but it was really thinking through how he wanted to structure the foundation. And it wasn't that he didn't have ideas. He had very well-developed ideas. He had thought a lot about it. But they needed to be sort of honed into an operating formula, something that gave him idea about how to proceed and how others could carry on after he wasn't around. And so it was very much a process of coming up with an operational working guideline for him and for our trustees and for me. Just a little bit of background. When Dan approached me about helping him develop a charter, as he called it back then, for his foundation, I was actually at the time running the philanthropy roundtable and decided to step down. I was having babies and stuff. And so I wanted to work part-time. And so Dan approached me, and he'd actually been a member of the philanthropy roundtable, and it was in reading philanthropy, which back then wasn't a magazine, but was just, you know, cheesy little newsletter that we put out. Up until that point, he had had what he called a PLU foundation. By that, he meant people like us. And he used his foundation to support the kinds of organizations that he and his friends and colleagues used, appreciated, were involved with, the Art Institute of Chicago, the Botanic Gardens, his alma mater, so on and so forth. And it was actually in reading philanthropy that he got the idea that he could have a foundation that would use philanthropic dollars to pursue his, to advance public policies that would preserve the American system as he understands it. And as he described it to me one day, he said, I can leave my kids, you know, I can leave them all the money in the world, but if they don't have their freedom, it's not going to do them any good. And so that's why he decided to change the mission of the foundation and wanted a very strong mission statement to reflect that. When he hired me, he had already been writing notes. He would actually dictate statements to his secretary and should type them up and put them in the file. And there were notes about how he was thinking about the foundation, what he wanted it to accomplish, the kinds of goals it would pursue, some of the issues that interested him. And he was very much focused on public policy. That was his interest, but how to shape that, he wasn't sure. So we started the process by, he sent me all these notes that he had written to his file. He also told me about books that he had read and that had influenced him, and I got the books and I read them. He sent me, as he read things, he would send me articles. The time, the American Enterprise Institute was the one think tank he was funding in a major way, and he was very much influenced by a lot of the work coming out of there. And he would just write, you know, down questions he wanted to answer. You know, I remember one of them was, you know, is there an alternative to capitalism as we know it? I mean, this was the kind of stuff he was thinking about. Not exactly. I think, oh, all right, that's an easy one to solve, Dan. Dan had all sorts of funny little phrases, and one of my favorites is he used to say, I have to read the Wall Street Journal to see what I think today. So now I've long been a loyal reader of the Wall Street Journal, but when I started working for Dan, I started reading the Wall Street Journal to see what he thought every day. And Dan died 3 years ago. I still read the Wall Street Journal to see what he would be thinking if he were alive today. And we would, you know, he would send me art, that was back in the days, faxes, and we used constantly back and forth, and he'd cut out pieces from the Wall Street Journal editorial page, comment on them, and say, you know, this guy's got a neat idea, can we pursue this, or do you know him, is he someone whose research we would support? So that's how we got thinking about these things. I, in turn, would then, I got him, you know, copies of annual reports and mission statements from foundations that were doing things similar to what I thought he might want to do. I would send him materials from other think tanks. AEI was the one he knew well, but I would try and introduce them to people who were at other think tanks and the work they were doing. The other thing we did that was, I think, somewhat unusual is we had a lot of meetings with people. So as we talked and I got a better idea of his what he was thinking about, I began to think that the foundation he was envisioning was probably more akin to the Olin Foundation, which has since shut down, but than any other. And so and that was an easy one. I had actually worked at Olin. So we went to New York, and we spent a day meeting with the folks from the Olin Foundation and learning how they went about their work and how they approached it. We met with other foundation people, Heather Higgins, Dave Kennedy from Earhart, all sorts of people. We also had a series of meetings with people from the policy world whose work he really appreciated. People like Charles Murray, back then John DiIulio was, I don't know if you guys know many of these names, but James Q. Wilson. They were all people whose work he admired, and so we would put together meetings. And I think what he would do is he'd ask these people, he'd say, if you were setting up a foundation, if you had my money, what would you do? What questions, what issues would you pursue? I think Dan went into these thinking there was, you know, maybe going to be a silver bullet, that Charles Murray would tell him, if only we could, you know, solve this problem, then America would be a better place and everything would be okay. Or maybe if we just focused on this one issue, that could be really where we'd put all his money and it would change everything. What really came out of the meetings is that he didn't find any silver bullet, and he decided that the way he would approach his giving would be to focus more generally on finding really good scholars. Dan is interested in a wide range of domestic public policy issues, and so what came out of these meetings was really that he was just going to try and find the best people he could and support their work, rather than focusing more on some more discrete kind of objective. We'd have these meetings. I'd go back and type up notes from them and send them to him, and we'd discuss them. We'd discuss the suggestions we got. We'd decide to pursue some, to dismiss others as you know, not relevant to his interests. I would also, I was surprised reading back through my stuff, I would sometimes write him memos asking him to clarify what he thought about certain things. For example, he, in his notes, he often referred to the importance of individual and responsibility of traditional values as sort of a corollary of individual freedom. You needed to have personal responsibility if you were going to be given all the freedom he thought people should have. And I said, well, you know, I wanted him to clarify what role he thought government should have in ensuring that people had those values or whatever, in implementing them. And as it turned out, Dan was really on those kinds of things. He thought traditional values were very important, but that government had no place in telling people how to live their lives. And so he had what one might describe as a very libertarian kind of perspective on this. And I think this wouldn't have come through unless if I hadn't asked him to clarify, because it was obvious to him. But it wasn't obvious to me what he was thinking. Anyway, we went through all these meetings. I finally at some point sat down and drew up a mission statement for him. I just took all his notes, all our correspondence, all the stuff we had been discussing, and tried to formulate it into what turned out to be a 6-page document. After I did that, he went through and paragraphs were added, paragraphs were deleted, sentences were massaged. There is not a word in that document that Dan didn't have there intentionally. I mean, you know, we had long debates over, do you refer to freedom or liberty? Do you refer to America as a democracy or a democratic republic? And this, you know, so there's, he was, every single word in there is intentional. Once we had a document he was happy with, we actually sent it out to about 24 people in the foundation world and the policy community, and we asked for their reactions to it. We got back, it was so fun to read through these things. It was awful to see how many of these people aren't around anymore, I have to say. but people wrote, you know, several page responses with comments, and we incorporated some, but not a lot. A lot of people said, you know, he should elaborate more on one thing or another. For every person who said that, someone said, shorten it. It should be, shouldn't be more than one page. And so what happened, I think, is we revised it again, but Dan took very few of those suggestions. And I think what the process did was really give him confidence in the document. No one said anything that he liked it the way it was. So after, it was actually 6 months from, I noticed this again going through my files, from his first notes to himself in his file to when we had a final document. It was a six-month process. So that's why I say I'm not sure everyone, I don't hold this out as a model necessarily. 6 months is kind of a long time to write a mission statement. But is it a good statement? And I think it's a very strong one. As a mission statement, I would hold it out. As a model, there are four sections to it, and he, Dan, how am I doing on time? Am I all right? I got okay. If I have time, I'll just, by way of example, take out very short sections to give you a sense of the flavor of it. The document is divided into four parts. The first part describes his intentions in establishing the foundation. So this is first couple sentences, how it starts out. I have established the foundation because I am concerned about certain social, political, and economic trends that I see in our society. I believe that if these trends continue unabated, future generations will end up living in a world dominated by big government, devoid of ethical values, and lacking in individual initiative and responsibility. With the resources I'm committing to the foundation, I want to encourage the restoration of personal responsibility to its central place in American life and to limit government's responsibilities to those areas the founding fathers intended. Okay, so that's a pretty powerful statement, you know, and that's just the start. It goes on from there. So, but you know, you get a pretty good sense of why he wanted to do this. What was motivating him? The next section he calls operating principles, and this is basically describes the ideas, the principles that he thinks should underlie the foundation's giving. So I'll just give you one short section from that. The foundation's work should reflect its dedication to public policies that emphasize the importance of the following: self-reliance as opposed to dependency, personal responsibility as a corollary of individual rights, individual merit in contrast to group entitlement, self-control as a prerequisite for self-expression, reliance on the private sphere before government, and values that are absolute, not relative. So there's a whole, you know, this is a whole couple pages of this where he's kind of describing his philosophy and his, you know, his way of thinking about life. The next section, called grant-making guidelines, actually gets much more specifically into the issues that animated him, that he was interested in, and that he wanted the foundation to address. And there are, I don't know, A, B, C, D, F, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 of them. And they range from tax policy to the litigiousness of society to school reform, so they environmental or a lot of regulatory policy he was interested in. So, and you know, a typical way he would describe something, like the paragraph on refers to taxation. He says the foundation will support policy research on the effects of various forms of taxation and other economic policies with the intent of advancing those policies which aim to promote the highest rate of growth that is compatible with a system of democratic capitalism. It follows that the foundation will uphold policies that lead to lower taxes, reduced government spending, and fewer government-imposed regulations. So that was a typical description of kinds of ways he was thinking about how we would approach particular issues. The last section, the fourth, is operating guidelines. And this, in this section, he actually talks about things that he doesn't want the foundation to support. Endowments, capital campaigns, no university overhead. That, by the way, is a very useful thing to have in a mission statement. We support lots of academic programs. We never pay overhead, and all we have to do is pull out the section from the mission statement, and the universities accept it. He also, this in this area, in this section of the document, he spent a lot of time addressing the extent to which he wanted the foundation to focus on research as opposed to advocacy or maybe demonstration projects. And where did it go? Real quickly what he says about that. He says, I do not wish the foundation's resources to be used to finance the widespread implementation of solutions or the ongoing operations of hands-on projects. Funds for these kinds of activities should be supplied by other sources. I intend for the foundation to support demonstration projects only to the extent they represent an integral part of the foundation's research interests, meaning the extent to which they help determine the effectiveness of proposed solutions to policy problems, not as they might come to resemble a more general form of charity. So I have to say that one paragraph has been unbelievably useful to us in deciding about certain grant requests we get, and that the guidance is one we refer back to frequently. That's the document. I guess what I would say about it is I think it ended up being a very good. It provides very, you've heard parts of it. It doesn't mince any words. You come out, you read it, and you know how Dan thought. Yet it also leaves, and it also addresses specific policy issues, yet it gives the trustees quite a bit of freedom about how to go about. He understood policy was going to change over time, they have lots of freedom to interpret how to address those policies at any given point in time. Having said that, one interesting thing is the mission statement, our board actually operates within narrower parameters than the mission statement allows them. In other words, our board had 10 years to work with Dan before he died. And there are parts of the mission statement. I'll give an example, because I'm not describing this very well. The mission statement refers to our country's founding values, the founding fathers, frequently. And so early on, I brought Dan quite a number of proposals for campus programs that are focused on teaching kids, you know, that are college students, the Constitution, that sort of thing. Turned out he wasn't interested in supporting those. And as I read back through the mission statement, I realized that he really used those words, the founding principles, kind of as shorthand, code words for the way he thought about things. So it didn't mean he really wanted to focus on supporting research in those areas. But this is something we would never have known if not for working with him for so long. And so there are a lot of requests we get that the mission statement, that are well within Dan's mission statement that the board could fund, but they often say, no, that's just, Dan wouldn't have done that. It wasn't him. So if anything, it's so far, our board operates almost, it's still thinking more about what Dan would have done than what he put in the mission statement. But with this mission statement, I don't think they're going to go off track in terms of, at worst, they might make a grant that Dan might not have wanted to make, but I don't think our board is going to make a grant that is supports something that is antithetical to his views on things. It's not going to go off course in terms of the philosophy. You know, our board has very vigorous debates. They're fun board meetings. They argue about all sorts of things. But like our last board meeting, the big debate was over the VAT tax. But the question was, would a VAT tax, you know, reduce our taxes or raise them? I mean, there was no question about what our goal was, that it was reducing taxes. The only question was a VAT tax a good way of getting there? So anyway, to conclude, I'd just say I think it was a long process, but left us with a document that the board can easily follow and will, I hope, not go off track. So I'm sorry to go. I feel like I went on too long. But, sorry.
Well, Kim, I think Dan and Bill Daniels probably had an awful lot in common. It was fun to hear you recap that. And what I thought I would do is tell you a little bit about Bill, in hindsight, what we wished he had done with his foundation, and tell you the 10 areas that we talk about a lot as trustees trying to interpret and implement Bill's vision, and then give you an example of what I mean. So our guy made his fortune in cable television. We lost him 10 years ago. He passed away in March of 2000. Prior to his death, he was the only trustee on his foundation, so we didn't have the benefit of overlap time with him, which would have been wonderful. Bill also had no immediate family, no children. His brother was named chair of the board initially, but it does not operate like a family foundation. The size now is just over $1 billion. Bill made the decision to establish the foundation in perpetuity, and I know there's a whole session on that a little bit later, but that's something to think about as well. Bill had emotional ties to places he called home or had significant business relationships. So he was very specific about what percentage of his foundation went to what geographic area, and very detailed, 5%, 10% here, there. He also was very specific about what portion went to a scholarship program and what portion went to a grants program. On the grants area, there are 10 funding areas, and that's where we get into trouble. They were not nearly as specific as I think he could have been in writing down what was important to him. Bill appointed a board of 7 trusted colleagues for life, and I'll tell you how that turned out in a little bit. I was one of them. It was so interesting because we would have these meetings, and it was as though we all knew a different guy, because we had known him in different aspects of his life. But in hindsight, in the first year of operation, the board absolutely lost control of donor intent. It took us less than 1 year. And what happened was that none of us had any experience with a foundation of that size. I happened to also be a trustee on Bill's estate, as was one of our other trustees, and we were trying to figure out how to settle this enormous estate. And we trusted the CEO that Bill had put in place to be handling the implementation of the mission. And what he did is probably what any of us would do in that situation. He said, we have an investment business, we have a grants business, and we have a scholarship business. I understand the investment business, so I'm going to hire the best person I can find with scholarship background and grants background. So in hindsight, what we hired to run those departments were people who could not have been further from Bill Daniels' values than I don't think we could have found them if we'd gone to central casting for opposite of. And it developed into a culture that was absolutely opposite of who Bill Daniels was and what he was all about. So the board woke up somewhat embarrassed. At that point, we had 70 members on the staff. We now operate with 39. We've closed offices in 4 states, or 3 states, centralized it into 1. We took all grant-making authority back to the board. I happened to chair the grants committee on the board at that point, and we went through each one of Bill's grant areas and said, we know this isn't what he meant. What did he mean? And the way we determined what he meant is we studied his personal philanthropy for the last 25 years, And Bill was a real prolific writer, and he happened to keep it all. So we have 40 years of this man's correspondence. So the gift would be, Kim, I'm sending you this money because. And it was the because that we kept looking for and the because that we began to track. And it was crystal clear after a little bit of this. Bill had a trusted attorney that he turned to write the documents. And we all love our attorneys, but they want to be flexible. They want to give you room to wiggle. And she did. So she wrote very vague statements. And the staff that was there that was not the Bill Daniels culture had all the room in the world to wiggle this thing into what they wanted it to be. So what resulted when the board woke up and took control was a couple of documents, one that we call Preserving Donor Intent, pardon me, where we actually took Bill's words and then provided a lot of interpretation to them based on the research of his personal philanthropy and his writings. And we worked on that until we had 100% of this board of seven that knew Bill in agreement that we had captured his values and captured who he was. And we still didn't feel like we had it. We still didn't feel like we understood the man's values or his personality. So we developed a second one called Understanding the Man Behind the Fund. And we listed 10 principles. You talked about principles. 10 principles that really identified who he was. Ethics, free enterprise, freedom, those kinds of things. And the Understanding the Man Behind the Fund became a second document that we worked on until every word was blessed by every board member. Then those two documents got attached to our bylaws, requiring a 90% vote to change a word. We went further and we said in the bylaws, once a year at the annual meeting, we will spend time with our old buddy Bill. And we will deliberately focus on who he was and what he was about. So we spend about an hour a year, and different directors will lead it, and we'll just laugh and tell Bill stories or whatever it is. We've taped all of these. We've got lots of video footage of Bill that we can use for future directors, but it's very interesting to just sit down and say, would Bill be proud? Bill always asked if his mother would be proud. Of the original seven directors that he named, his foundation's been there for 10 years, there are two of us left. And I'm in a different role now as CEO of the foundation in 10 years. Bill also said, here's a list of buddies that I think you ought to call on when you need to replace directors. But we decided early on that was not very healthy because there was no accountability in a structure like that. So we determined four-year terms, and we said they could be repeated, but only after a peer review of people on the board to say, are they holding their end of the deal? Are they coming prepared? Are they really honoring donor intent as opposed to personal agenda? And I think it is extremely hard to be on a foundation board and not have your personal agenda enter into it. It is extremely hard. We are all people that have had experiences in life and have value systems, and so this constant reminder of it's not our dough, it's his dough, and what would he want done with it was really important. I think it would have been very helpful if he had said, when you consider future directors, look for these qualities instead of saying look for these people. Some of the 10 things I think that we've spent time talking about, do you care what happens to the foundation in the future? I mean, maybe you don't. Maybe it's as simple as saying, I trust whoever's handling it at the time to make the best decision. If you do care, write it. Ask yourself why. Ask yourself why. Ask yourself why. Ask yourself until you can't stand it anymore. But it's drilling down into what are the characteristics that are really important. The perpetuity question is really, really significant. My observation in this business for the few years I've been involved with it is that it is extremely difficult to preserve donor intent in perpetuity. It drifts almost always. Values and beliefs. I thought Kim did a great job of talking about what were the principles that defined the guy and what was really important to him. Is ideology important? If it is, don't say I'm a Republican or I'm a Democrat. Say these are the things that are important to me because the definitions change over time. Bill wrote a letter to the seven trustees that was this long, said, remember, I am a conservative. the only thing I have in common with liberals is, and then he listed 10 things. So anybody on the board could debate any point of view that they wanted. What did that mean to Bill was the hard part we had in interpreting it. Religion is another thing that was really interesting about Bill. I never had a conversation. I worked for Bill for 15 years before the foundation was formed, and I never had a conversation about religion, nor did any of the seven on the board. We find out after he passes that he had a pastor that he talked to daily, that they were very spiritual, that Bill had all this aspect to him. So we've interpreted that to say, let's not stay away from spiritual related programs. But none of us knew that that existed. Bill would probably be defined more than anything by his love of free enterprise, his love of business, his love of entrepreneurship. And that didn't come through very strongly in his written documents. So I think you ask yourself, what are you passionate about? Bill had lots of interests, probably more than it's practical to be really good at. But what are you really passionate about, and what aren't you? Bill said no medical research. A lot of people are doing that. I don't want my money to go to that, not because I don't believe in it, but I think it belongs over here. His mother was into the arts, and he had said to a couple of us, if I never go to another ballet, it will be too soon. So don't take my money and spend it on that. That's how he felt about the arts. So he was clear on those. How do you want to address the passion is a whole other component. There's so many ways to do foundation business. The bank that I worked with Bill on was an example of operating a program because he didn't trust anybody else to do it the way he wanted to do it. Do you want to do that kind of programming, or do you want to make grants to people who are going to do the programming? Do you like startups? Do you like, funding expansion kinds of programs? Bill's philanthropy, when you looked at it, had more to do with people than it did subject. He would meet people, and he would say, I believe in this person, and he had an incredible knack for understanding whether people had the chutzpah to deliver what he wanted done or not. That's extremely difficult to translate to a program officer who has probably never run a business, never made a payroll, never done a number of these things. It's very, very different environment. Capital grants was another area. We do a little bit of everything, and I guess I wish Bill had narrowed that thinking down a little bit more because I think we'd have more impact. And I think if he were here, impact would be important. Evaluation is another component. We talk a lot about it in foundations. How important is that to the donor? How important is evaluation? Do you really want to spend the money on evaluation, or do you really not care? If Bill were here today, he would be wanting to know he was having an impact, but he wouldn't want us to be spending a lot. He would expect us to know it in our hearts, whether it was working or not. But I think the directive documents that you leave for people, the clearer you can be and the whys are what's really, really critical. And then the last two points, future directors, all of the people on our board up to the very last person we brought on knew Bill really, really well. And we brought on the first person that did not. And we did that so that we had overlap with people so that you could get the values planted and carried forward. But where do we go from here? Now it's up to this board to figure out. So we're having conversations that would drive Bill crazy, frankly, if he heard the conversations about the next director and where do we go. And then the last thing that I don't think Bill thought about at all was who would be running the foundation, the staff characteristics. I think Bill hung around with entrepreneurs. He liked entrepreneurs. He liked business people. Assumed they'd be running foundations. You've got some executives in foundations who are business people, but for the most part, program officers are people who've never made money, don't have money, and have a social agenda. So you've got to pay close attention to that they're not bringing their personal agenda into the foundation to give away someone else's dough. I went through an exercise with our board a while back, and I said, you've got two of us, Hank Brown and myself, on the board now who've been the CEO. You ought to take some time and document what this job is really about because it isn't what it looks like from the outside so that you have the benefit of that, if I get hit by the truck kind of thing. And what I talked about and what Hank talked about as well is that someone who's never had responsibility for the revenue side of anything has a different respect for money than someone who's had to make it, whether it was in a fundraising environment or in a business environment. Having responsibility for the revenue side gives you a different appreciation of the dough. So here's the example. Bill Daniels wrote one of the many funding areas, support innovative education initiatives such as charter schools, voucher programs, and elementary class adoptions that tend to improve private or public educational systems. Have you ever met a nonprofit that doesn't have an innovative educational program? So the first year we funded everything that the staff thought was an innovative educational program. What Bill could have said is he wanted to improve K-12 education, and there were plenty of writings about that. He could have said he was concerned about our position in the global marketplace, which he was. He could have said that taxpayers are getting cheated because we're paying for an education system that's not delivering. He could have said education hasn't changed for decades and everything else in the world has. He could have said that unions may have had a place in the history, but they don't in education now. He could have said that he believed deeply in the free market system and choice, which would have helped given us a lot of direction. He could have said that he had observed private schools and charters as having the flexibility to get the job done and being really a good way to work with that. He could have said discipline and respect were extremely important to him, and he was an ex-military guy. Discipline and respect were everything to him. He could have said that schools of education aren't preparing teachers the right way, and boy, did he believe that. He didn't believe business schools were preparing business students the right way either. He could have said he was concerned about political leanings that were being taught to our students. He could have said that the ultimate game is employability so that people contribute to society when they get out. He would be mortified to see business bashing that goes on in a number of the universities now. He would have been an absolute advocate for competition. He thought competition was everything. And how do you translate into the workplace the culture that we have now that, you know, competition, everybody wins, let's all get a ribbon kind of thing. I think he would have expected parents to step up to the table and be parents and take the responsibility on those. And he could have also said, this whole dual language thing we're doing is slowing us all down. This is America. So those are the things we found when we went back through his documents to try and add some color to what he really meant. But I would encourage you, if you're writing your mission statement, to really spend the time. I think Bill spent 4 years working on this and still didn't give us as much direction as you would like for the person who is really trying to implement it. And I think if you've written yours and you want people who are running foundations to react to it, we're more than happy to say you might get in a little trouble here or there, or here's how someone might take that and interpret it their way, or, you know, whatever you want to do with it. So that's my thoughts. And I did kind of summarize those for you on a handout that you have at the table.
Linda, I'm curious, how many of your original... Oh, sorry. How many of your original trustees are still trustees? Did they all survive this process of going through and looking at Mr. Daniels' intent? And
the original ones, minus Bill's brother, all went through the intent component and then have left for one reason or another. Bill's brother developed Alzheimer's shortly after Bill died. So you think about naming a trustee for life, and now you've got the brother with Alzheimer's. And several of us were thinking, wow, how in the world are we going to handle this? And thank God his brother was aware of what was going on, and he said, I need to step down. I'm not able to do that. And his daughter, Bill's niece, came on the board at that point. But those are the kinds of things you have to anticipate, is give some chance for change if you need to. But we've had a lot of turnover on the board in just 10 years, I think.
We've had zero. Well, we added one family member, actually. It's been consistent. No, I dug out as you were talking about his Bill Daniels section on education. You know, Dan's, by contrast, is, you know, the foundation will support public policy programs that promote the development of an educational system that encourages and maybe even in some cases demands the involvement of parents in choosing both the kind of school their children attend and the learning process itself. So it's, you know, just a direct contrast, and it goes on from there. So.